ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, it's Lisa Leong from This Working Life, helping to make your work life better with advice from the world's top experts, like psychotherapist Esther Perel.
Many conflicts are about power. Power is when I dismiss what you're bringing up. Power is when I magnify a problem.
And Professor Adam Grant.
We need to take our critics and our cheerleaders and turn them into coaches.
Free coaching! Search for This Working Life on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Stand to!
On the 25th of April, each and every year, Anzac Day, Australians gather to remember their war dead.
They shall grow not old as we that are left grow old. Age shall not weary them, nor the years condemn.
The Anzac tradition, like the military legends of many countries, has long been focused on bonds of comradeship, of the mateship forged between men in battle. But in recent years, that male-centric focus has begun to shift as more and more women choose to take up a military role. And just a few days ago, the Australian government announced that the new chief of the Australian Army will be Lieutenant General Susan Coyle, the first woman to ever hold the nation's top army post. The way we think about women in a military capacity has also begun to shift as more and more research uncovers the historic part played by women in warfare. Hello, Anthony Fennell here. Welcome to Rear Vision.
So the history of women in warfare is that women have always been on the battlefield. And in fact, the period of time that we look at the absence of women from the battlefield, we might see that period of time as abnormal.
Associate Professor Sarah Percy, author of Forgotten Warriors, a history of women on the front line.
So we have a chunk of time in the 20th century from World War I through to the end of World War II, where women were largely not present in Western militaries. But throughout history before that, the battlefield is a band of brothers and sisters. There are women fighting. There are women who are dressed as men fighting. There are women commanding troops. There are women who are in combat adjacent roles, providing logistics, providing food, providing water. So there are women all over the battlefields of history. We have just chosen to pretend that they weren't there. And those moments when we choose to pretend they're not there, historically, those are often moments where we have a reason to try and suppress women's rights more broadly, or a reason to be concerned about women's advocacy for their own rights.
Enter Pete Hegseth, Donald Trump's enthusiastic Secretary of War, who's been very vocal in his doubts about the role of women in the US military, and who's currently conducting a review into the ability of women to perform in combat. But who, it has to be said, has already declared his hand.
I'm straight up just saying we should not have women in combat roles. It hasn't made us more effective, hasn't made us more lethal, has made fighting more complicated. You've got top-down political generals who've gained rank by playing by all the wrong rules. They'll do any social justice, gender, climate, extremism crap.
Today on the show, we'll talk about the potential implications of the Hegseth Review. But let's first look at the historic struggle women have had to join their male comrades in combat and have their service recognised. Take the experience of Ashley Percival Bawley.
I was 19 years old when I joined the British Army, and I actually wanted to kind of experience what it would be like in combat. But as a woman, I couldn't do that. So the only way I could get close enough to the front line to kind of test myself in that way, I come from a forces background, was to be a combat medic. So I joined as a combat medical technician, and I served for 13 years. I was a senior non-commissioned officer, and I served in Afghanistan. And I get really frustrated because I very much was on the front line. I was a soldier with one Royal Irish Regiment. I was attached to A Company. And I was their combat medic. And while I was not combat medicing, I was just a bod. I was a bloke on the front line. I fired my weapon in the same direction. I did compound clearances. I jumped into irrigation ditches to avoid grenades. I took cover behind compounds when we were shot at. And it really frustrates me when they say, yeah, but, you know, women shouldn't really be in combat, or they haven't been. And I think, goodness, gosh, what was I doing then? And my fellow women medics, we were all on the front line doing frontline roles.
What was the attitude of the men around you on the front line?
It was about whether you could do your job. You were tested, and every medic was, whether they were male or female, you were tested to see if you could handle it. The battlefield, it kind of doesn't care whether you're a man or woman. It's as long as you can do your role. And my blokes looked after me because I was a medic, not because I was a woman. I was an asset. They needed me for every patrol. I had to go on every patrol. I wasn't given a break. And my capability outweighed whatever gender I was.
Now, it's only in the past few decades in the West that women like Ashley have been allowed back onto the battlefield. And as Sarah Percy touched on earlier, their removal from the front lines and from the military history books in the 20th century was by no means accidental.
I think that by the time we are rolling through the 20th century, it is an absolute deliberate forgetting. And part of the reason for that deliberate forgetting is that the 19th century battlefield and the 18th century battlefield have a lot of women on them. So the idea that we have a sharp separation between a home front where the women are hanging out and they're safe and they're at home being quiet mothers and wives, and a battlefront where the men are out doing the business of fighting, that's a World War I and onwards phenomenon. Prior to that, what we see is the presence of an enormous amount of women on the battlefield. Now, they're not all fighting, right? Like, they're often there nursing, they're there in support roles. But the point is, they were there experiencing the danger and the fighting alongside men. So one of the things that women often do, there are a lot of wives who follow the British military, and they kind of have to pay their own way, or they have to earn their keep. And they do that by doing things like delivering water on the battlefield. And they're not, you know, hanging it out at the back delivering the water. They are up at the front, and we have evidence of them. If their husband or partner falls at the guns, we have evidence of them stepping in and taking their place and continuing to fire the guns. So when we started to sort of socially construct this idea that women were completely inappropriate to fight, we had to deliberately forget that they were there in the first place, because otherwise you have evidence of women's capacity to do things. And I don't think it's any coincidence this happens at around the time the women's suffrage movement really begins to take off. So when women start demanding, very successfully demanding for a political voice, it's extremely helpful to be able to say to those pesky women who are demanding equality that there are still fields of endeavor in which you cannot be a woman. And that field of endeavor is the military, which is, of course, very closely linked to the active suffrage and voting in most Western democracies. So how we get the vote is through military service. So how suffrage gets extended to men is the more different types of person we conscript. The trade-off is, we'll conscript you, you have to fight for us, but we'll give you democratic voting rights in exchange. And by blocking that road off to women entirely, it's a very handy way of preventing the extent of suffrage to women, but also reminding women, supposedly, what their capacities are and are not.
And when you then determine that women have no place in combat situations, you then have to codify it. Make it official. Megan McKenzie, Professor of International Studies at Simon Fraser University in Vancouver.
So the combat exclusion was primarily used to refer to actually what was a series of policies that prevented women from serving on what is known as the front line, so infantry and armor. There is no single combat exclusion policy, but there were a series of policies in the U.S. and other countries that kept women from serving in these frontline roles.
I don't think there's a gender issue. I think there's a cultural myth. And it's because historically, war and masculinity has been mashed together. And it's also to do with citizenship in ancient Rome. If you served in the Roman army, you could then have citizenship, etc. So there's kind of these cultural anxieties that are projected onto the military. So I think there's a myth where it comes to, well, women shouldn't serve because of X, Y, and Z. And that's a societal myth. That is society creating arguments to stop a particular type of people serving. And it's not just women, it's obviously been people of colour, it's been all sorts of people as well. And that is because military policy ultimately reflects societal values as much as it reflects battlefield realities. And it's a myth that persists because each generation kind of claims that the issue is new, but every generation thinks it's the first to kind of face this question of oh, should women be in combat?
In countries like Australia, Canada, and the United States, the removal of the combat exclusion came gradually. In Australia in the mid-1970s, a Defence Working Party was established to look at the role women could or should play in the military. That working party recommended that women be allowed to undertake active service, but stopped short of endorsing women as frontline combatants. The full integration of women into the Australian military only came about in 2016. So how many countries now allow women to serve in a combat capacity?
So that's a really difficult question to answer, only because different countries define combat and define front lines slightly differently. You know, it's about 20, depending on how you define combat. And certainly we have, you know, Australia, New Zealand, US, Canada, many countries in Europe. Israel is a good example that many think of. And then there's a few other countries that, you know, it does depend on how you define combat. And certainly not all countries agree on that definition.
I know that in some of the Scandinavian countries, reservists and conscripts are women and they're trained to fight in combat, aren't they?
That's right. And I think there's certainly debate amongst many of the Scandinavian countries. And that debate really centers around equality and making sure that women are seen as full citizens, are seen as equal, that they're contributing equally. We know in Norway, for example, we have women and men sleeping in the same quarters. There's a real effort to sort of enforce a kind of equality that's different in other armies.
When did we start to see a greater acceptance in Western countries of the idea that women weren't just support, they could actually take on combat duties?
Well, to be honest, the public opinion shifted earlier than internal opinion on these issues. And so the public wasn't as fussed about the idea of women in combat as I think many people may imagine. There was sort of this argument, oh, well, the public is going to struggle with the idea of women coming home in body bags. And we saw in Iraq and Afghanistan that when women died on the front lines, it didn't impact public opinion on that conflict. It really didn't shift public perceptions. The public weren't more concerned with female deaths than they were with men. And so certainly the public was more open to the idea of women fighting on the front lines than senior leaders within the armed forces. And it's an interesting story, particularly if you compare Australia and the US. Part of the driver of this policy change was scandal and problems within those defense forces. So if you think back to 2011, 2012, in the Australian context, you had what was infamously referred to as the Skype sex scandal, which was, you know, a case made famous of a cadet who had consensual sex with a male comrade, but had that sex, you know, broadcast without her consent. So many people know that, maybe not everyone will know that case. But what that case sparked was a series of reviews within the Australian context around culture, around climate, around, you know, discrimination of women. And so one of the solutions, I guess, that was brought up, or one of the reforms that was brought to the table, was this idea of removing the combat exclusion as sort of a signal of movement towards equality. And similarly in the US, the scandals around ongoing sexual violence and sexism with the institution, removing the combat exclusion was seen as, you know, at least partially a solution to that problem.
Was there much pushback in countries like the US, Australia, Canada, when women began to take on combat roles?
You know, what's really surprising is at the time, there wasn't. I think partly because it came on the heels of these very high profile scandals where the public was sort of grappling with sexism within the defense forces. That's not to say that there weren't conservative voices who strongly opposed this policy change, but I would say it was the minority. Most of the public, it sort of went by without a lot of discussion. It was embraced with a few conservative voices, you know, expressing concern.
And you're listening to Rear Vision, an ABC Radio National production, giving you the essential backstory to today's issues and events. I'm Anthony Fennell. This month, as Australia announces a woman, Lieutenant General Susan Coyle, is the new Chief of Army, we look at the historic role that women have played in warfare. And we also ask why the US seems to be turning its back on women in combat roles.
The issue is that many of these defense forces that removed the combat exclusion, I think, put so much weight on this policy change. They thought, okay, it's going to solve our sexual harassment problem. It's going to help our recruitment issue. It's going to help us with retention. We're going to see more female leaders. And that's a lot of weight to put on a single policy change without many more mechanisms to address sexism within the defense forces. So essentially, none of that has happened. We see in the Canadian context and New Zealand context who have had women in combat roles for, you know, a very long time. And for the Canadian case, it was 1989. So we've had women in combat, you know, have the opportunity to be in combat roles for a long time. The reality is not many women want those jobs for many reasons. One, it is still a boys' club, and there still isn't that pipeline of women that offer the support. So you don't see this policy change resulting in significant change in terms of recruitment, retention, and culture change. That doesn't mean it wasn't the right policy choice. It just means that it isn't sort of a solution to all of those issues.
Megan McKenzie in Vancouver.
So I was a Marine. I was an attack pilot in the Marine Corps. I flew AH-1 Whiskey Super Cobra attack helicopters.
Dr. Kylie-Ann Hunter, the CEO of the IAVA, the Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America.
Combat aviation had not been open to women for very long at this point, and there were very, very, very few women in combat aviation still. And, you know, I entered a very, very male-dominated world. Just aviation in general has always been very male-dominated, even in the civilian sector. At first, I didn't really recognize it that much that I was unique or different. And I think it was because everyone who was there was just in over their head and it was a fire hose to try to survive. Going through training is tough in general. And so I didn't notice as much until I got selected for the Cobra community, for the attack community. And the way the Marines work their aviation selection is it's not really up to you. They tell you what you're going to go fly. You know, it's the needs of the Marine Corps. And when I was qualified for and hit the numbers to be a Cobra pilot, that's when I think for the first time I started to feel that there was a real gender difference. There were a lot of men who didn't think that I deserved it, you know, that the slot was wasted on a woman, that I was going to be a washout, that I would never make it through.
And as I'm sure you can guess, that criticism turned out to be nonsense. Dr. Hunter rose to the rank of major and served multiple combat tours in both Iraq and Afghanistan. She believes it was the modern nature of those wars, the messy, asymmetric nature of them, that finally saw the end of America's combat exclusion policy.
I think there's two big things that happened that were very important. One is the fact that the way the women in ground combat exclusion had been framed had to do with the types of units that women were allowed to be in, right? These units like infantry, artillery, tanks that were seen as frontline combat units. The way the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan were being fought, there wasn't a front line. You know, one of the most dangerous jobs to have in any of those conflicts was to be a supply convoy driver, the way IEDs and ambushes had. So first and foremost, it became very, very clear that the distinction between frontline combat and not frontline combat was just gone with the way the war was fought. Women had been in supply and logistics and engineers for a long time, and that was incredibly dangerous. You know, IEDs, ambushes, they didn't attack infantry units. They attacked supply convoys. So that was number one. You know, the front lines came to women. Number two is that when we were thinking about counterinsurgency operations, it became also very, very clear that infantry units that were all men just could not do the job because they could not engage with half of the population. You know, cultural customs dictated that, you know, if there was an infantry unit that was doing a village stability operation and a counterinsurgency and going in and trying to not just, you know, root out and kill the bad guys, but win hearts and minds, secure areas, train people, they needed access to the women in those populations. And a bunch of male infantry, Marines, and soldiers weren't going to cut it. And so they needed to bring women into these missions. And so we have things like the Lioness program was created in Iraq, and it was sort of then turned into the female engagement teams that we saw in Afghanistan and bigger in Iraq, where we would attach women to these frontline units to be able to work in the villages and work side by side by women. And there were all sorts of like legal limbo that we basically played to make this happen, right? In terms of, are they considered attached or assigned? And if they're there for 28 days, is it okay to pull them away, right? So we, in order to meet operational necessity, right, do what we had to do to meet our military objectives, we had to bring women, you know, into the quote unquote fight in the front lines. And so we sort of made excuses and skirted our way around the law to do it.
After retiring from the military, Kylie-Anne Hunter went on to lead the Women, Peace and Security Initiative at the Department of Defense. She was the director of the Strategy and Warfare Center at the United States Air Force Academy, and she headed a subcommittee of the Defense Department Advisory Committee on Women in the Services. That last body, known as Dakowitz, was last year disbanded by the US Secretary of War, Pete Hegseth, as part of his self-declared war on woke. He also ended Dr. Hunter's Women, Peace and Security program, declaring it an initiative that, quote, overburdens our commanders, distracting from our core task, warfighting.
The disbanding of the Defense Advisory Committee on Women in the Services, which had been around for over 70 years. This is not new. This is not something that was a Biden-era program. This has been around since basically right after World War II. The work that was done by an organization like Dakowitz, they did things, everything from ensuring that there was properly fitting gear and equipment for everyone, right? Proper like safety equipment to have, you know, the companies who design the, whether it's a ejection seat for an aircraft or a bulletproof vest, but having to continually redo anthropomorphic studies to make sure that their supply chain is accurately reflective of the body types that are in the military, which doesn't just benefit women, it benefits everybody. The work that Dakowitz did was really essential work for ensuring that the policies and practices of the Department of Defense align with the realities of the people who are volunteering to serve. And then in terms of women, peace, and security, you know, thankfully, the WPS Act is still a law. So there still is a law in the U.S. that says it is the sense of Congress that we have to keep enacting women, peace, and security. How it's getting enacted, though, is a big problem. And I think when we look at WPS and really centering women, peace, and security principles, I have a huge concern about how quickly they were dismissed, because we saw the fact that their adoption led to better military effectiveness overall, right? When we adopt principles that don't just think about, okay, who do we need to kill and how many people do we need to kill and how many things do we need to blow up, but really center the, okay, who may not be involved in this conflict directly, but is going to be impacted? And what are our actions going to do to them? How are we bringing civil society into the reconstruction of this country in the post-conflict area? And how are we even fighting the war in a way that recognizes that in the aftermath, we have a civil society component that's going to have to be a part of rebuilding? And we know that looking at problems from more than one angle leads to better solutions. And at the end of the day, that's what Women, Peace, and Security really did. It said, hey, let's look at this whole war combat thing through completely different lenses and see it through a different set of eyes, and maybe we'll get a different set of tactical, operational, and strategic approaches. And if we do that, we get better outcomes.
It's always inspiring to stand amongst patriots who quite literally are building our nation's firepower. I had a chance this morning to swear in some new recruits. We have a historic recruiting surge at the Department of War. Record amounts of Americans want to join our uniform class.
So Pete Hegseth, we knew who Pete Hegseth was coming in as Secretary of Defense, now calling himself Secretary of War. He, you know, was a Fox pundit and wrote a book prior to his appointment to this role called The War on Warriors, where he makes very clear in that book and in podcast interviews related to that book that he did not think women should be integrated into combat units. He's been quoted multiple times. He thought it was, you know, kind of a failed experiment. And he perpetuates myths around this, especially that the standards were lowered, that there were quotas to get more women in, which none of that is true. There were never quotas for women. Nothing was lowered for women. Women really had to prove themselves. In fact, they had to sort of be exceptional to be accepted into those roles. So he's made it clear that he wants a review on this, meaning that he wants essentially a lot of data around social cohesion, task cohesion within units to see how women have impacted units, to look at whether they've positively or negatively impacted. The issue with this is, I mean, not to get too much into the weeds, but there's two ways of looking at cohesion in units. We use this term cohesion. There's task cohesion. It's like whether or not, you know, having diverse groups helps for them to do better at their job, like whether task cohesion is enhanced. And then there's social cohesion. Very different things. Social cohesion is whether you like working with someone. And we know that social cohesion is very specific. You know, white guys like to work with other white guys. Middle-aged women like to work with other middle-aged women. That's just, there's lots of research to show that. And so there's data to show that women do disrupt social cohesion, definitely. Men who haven't worked with women don't want to work with women. That has actually changed over time. We know that when men in the armed forces start to work with women, they change their minds. But there is evidence to show that women disrupt social cohesion. So my concern now is that they'll be able to look through all of this data, show that women are disruptive, but focus on this one part versus the other. And the possibility is that women could be kicked out of their jobs in infantry and armor. We have about 5,000 women who could be kicked out of their roles, including senior leaders, including leaders who have received extremely commendable reviews over the last almost decade. And it would be a huge loss. I expect there would be lawsuits. And I expect that the Army would really struggle with recruitment and retention of women moving forward.
Would it have an influence if that comes to pass? Would it have an influence on the way in which other militaries operate?
I don't know. I don't think that many countries at the moment are looking to the U.S. as a model of how to operate their government. That's not to say that we couldn't have a populist leader come into Australia or Canada, for example, and take a note from their playbook. I think it will make it harder for women in the armed forces across the world because for those people within the armed forces who don't want women there, who are sexist and hold sexist beliefs, it will fuel those sexist beliefs and make it more difficult than it already is for women to prove themselves.
Meghan McKenzie. And even though she's a Brit, not an American, former combat medic Ashley Percival Bawley finds Pete Hegseth's words and actions frustrating and galling.
We have to think that conflict now is far more complex than it's kind of ever been. And the future operating environment needs creativity, innovation. You need different decision makers to create a tactical outcome that will lean into an operational output. And if you're streamlining your military to only 50% of your population, you're losing part of that creativity. We are in a three-dimensional, four-dimensional battlefield. We're in warfare that we can't even see. And we need those different brains, those different backgrounds, those different types of people to lean into the different echelons of war fighting we have now. And I'm angry that a society like the US, which is supposed to be so forward-thinking, is not acknowledging the role women can play in the military in this very complicated, very complex future operating environment where who knows where the threats are going to come from.
And the last word to former attack helicopter pilot, Kylie-Anne Hunter.
So I'm hoping this is a blip, right? I hope this is a sort of an out of sync because, you know, everything that we have seen for the past 25 years points to women's success in combat. However, what this has done that I've seen is it gives rise to a very vocal minority that is able to, you know, manipulate feelings in order to attempt to deny half the population military service. And I worry what the ripple effect that's going to have because, you know, one of the hardest things to change is cultures and sentiment and belief. And when somebody sort of gets like the genie out of the bottle, it's really hard to put it back in and say, oh, no, we were just kidding. We actually really want you here. It's going to be really hard to convince women that they are wanted again.
The long battle women have fought for recognition as warriors and the Trump administration's efforts to once again force them from the field. You've been listening to Rear Vision, an ABC Radio National production. We heard today from Kylie-Anne Hunter at the IAVA, the Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America, Associate Professor Sarah Percy from the University of Queensland, Ashley Percival Bawley, a military historian at Durham University in the UK and a former combat medic, and Meghan McKenzie, Professor of International Studies at Simon Fraser University in Canada. I'm Anthony Fennell. Thanks for joining us. Until next time, cheers.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.